And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's my pleasure to welcome Greg Iles back to the program today. Greg is one of the most successful writers of thrillers in America. He recently wrapped up the Natchez Burning trilogy starring Mayor Penn Cage. This time around, he heads 40 miles north to the fictional town of Bienville, Mississippi, where a group of cronies called the Poker Club hold the true reins of power. But recently returned newspaperman Marshall McEwen must deal with a story of truth, murder, and the economic well-being of everyone in town. The book is Cemetery Road, and it's published by William Morrow. Greg, after the Natchez Burning trilogy and three other Penn Cage books, you've decamped for another town. This one's called Bienville, Mississippi, and where would it be if it were actually in existence?
If it were actually in existence, it would be about 40 miles north of Natchez and 40 miles south of Vicksburg. Now, that geography doesn't technically work out with the real world perfectly, but it's sort of a mixture of those two towns and some others. And I'm scared to death that I made it so real we're going to get tourists looking for it, on the, you know, coming from Australia or something. That happens.
Is there actually land there, or would you be in the river at that point?
Really, there's not that much space. Natchez and Vicksburg are really about 60 miles apart, so there's not as much land as – I created a fictional county, not just a fictional town, a small county, but I gave it such a historical context, I think some historians will just assume it's real, you know?
Are you going to keep going back to this county, or is this a one and done?
Now, I thought it was a one and done, and I've gotten involved in politics in the last 3 years, Natchez mayoral politics, and then statewide politics to a degree, really national politics when you think about it, anonymously. And I've learned a lot in those elections. And it's very tempting to do sort of a all the king's men type of behind the scenes. And so Bienville will lend itself to that.
While everything seems très bien in Bienville, if you're writing about it, there's got to be some bad things going on.
Yeah, one thing I did in here, if you get away from the core of the novel, is explore the idea of the poker club, you know, the people who are the antagonists. They are typical of what exists in so many southern towns, really all towns, which is a small group of powerful guys who hold the real decision-making power. That's one thing you learn as you go from being a boy to a man, is that positions of nominal power are never where the real control is in a city or a town. It's the people with the money. Sometimes in the South, it's people with six or seven generations of lineage and they have contacts. But it's not just southern towns. I mean, New England was that way. Not to go on too much, but every industry is that way. Silicon Valley's like a small town. Different, the music business is a small town. So everything really runs that way.
I mean, science fiction writers have been trying to warn us the corporations are going to be the true controlling entities and not countries in the future. And dang it if it's just not happening right in front of our eyes.
I was going to say, we're past. Yeah, it's not starting to happen. Robert Ludlum used to do that in his books. And I thought that was, God, he seems obsessed with this sort of the corporatocracy, corporate bad guys. And he was prescient, really.
The first chapter of Cemetery Road, our first-person narrator tallies up some of his successes and some of his failings in life. And in Marshall McEwen, you've created a very flawed protagonist.
Yes, I have. Well, I don't know too many heroes in real life. And even heroes in real life, if you dig very deep below the surface, you find, you know, mortality, feet of clay. That's just human nature. So it's not interesting for, you know, Penn Cage, I'll say, if Penn Cage has a flaw, he's a little too good. You know, he's too much of a Boy Scout. And Marshall's not a Boy Scout. That was a relief.
Well, he is a journalist that's been around the world, so he's probably had to make some compromises in his
time. Exactly. And that's what, you know, aside from the personal of what this book is about, that's what it's really about. It's what is justice really? What is the best you can do? You know, because a boy's idea of justice is, you know, perfection and balance and everything being right. Once I heard a federal judge say, you know what justice is? Justice, real justice is everybody getting what we deserve, and none of us wants that.
Now, his name does sound similar to Marshall McLuhan. Why did you do that?
I'll tell you why, because the guy has a Scottish heritage. I like the name McEwen, and it was close, I knew, to McLuhan. But here's what I think. Real life is like that a lot of times. People have names that are close to other names, confusing. And I said, why be scared of that? Just let it be what it is. Now, I paid for that. I went on my buddy Mitch Albom's radio show a week ago, and when he brought up the very thing you did, he started playing in the background audio the scene of the Woody Allen movie where Marshall McLuhan walks on it. I felt like an idiot, but it was funny.
But if we do go back to Marshall McLuhan's quote about the medium being the message and there's an intrinsic nature in each medium and how it conveys,
yeah.
What do you think is the intrinsic nature of the small town newspaper?
The intrinsic nature of, in real life, of the small town newspaper, sort of boosterism. They figured out that the profit is not in news, but in reporting the T-ball scores and the social calendar and things like that. They don't really exist as a, for example, an investigative news agency. I mean, now and then they'll get on a story, but small town papers survive off small town advertisers. And of course, these days that changes a little bit with the way the internet works, but still. I know the guys who run the paper in Natchez. They're good guys, but those papers, they never existed to be organs of uncovering truth relentlessly, right? That's not their gig. That's not what they do.
Marshall won a Pulitzer, and so did his dad, so it's a pretty rare combo right there.
There are some strong influences on the dad character there, the sort of Greenville Delta Democrat Times, Hiding Carter. There's some other brave journalists in Mississippi who did not toe the line during the Civil Rights Movement. And I wanted him to have that lineage. But then again, he was flawed, right? He was called the conscience of Mississippi. He was a legend, but he became an alcoholic pretty soon after. And he's been an alcoholic since the 60s, you know? So again, on one hand, he's a hero. On the other hand, he's flawed.
Later on in the story, talking about similar names, there's a doctor named Jack Kirby. I was wondering how much...
Yeah.
How many comic books you read when you were a kid to name that fellow Jack Kirby?
Well, I don't know. I'm thinking, who am I thinking? Is there a Jack Kirby? Who am I thinking about?
Yeah, he and Stan Lee did a lot of...
He's Stan Lee's guy? Okay. Yeah. I was sitting there conflating the names, thinking Stan Kirby. The comic guys are going to go, that guy didn't know anything, whatever. No, I was a Spider-Man guy, man, coming up. Totally. I don't know why. What is it about Spider-Man? But, you know.
Well, with great power comes great responsibility.
There you go. There you go. See, here's the thing. Okay, tell me what year you were born. Let's reveal it.
69.
See, 69. I'm 60. The guys I know from your generation were way heavier into comics than mine. We read comics, but it wasn't like a religion like it was for the guys I know.
But I wasn't a religious person coming in that regard. I just would borrow someone's comics every once in a while.
Okay, gotcha.
I like Casper and Richie Rich as much as I did the superheroes when
okay,
I was a kid.
Wow. Gotcha.
That first chapter is just a short little admission of sins and accomplishments. But the action begins in chapter 2, and there's a man named Buck Ferris, and he's digging where he's not supposed to.
Yeah. There's a guy somewhat like this in Natchez who helped me a lot. And the real-life guy didn't do things to disturb the small teapot of that area. There might have been places he could have looked and things he could have done. But, you know, you got to get by in certain jobs you're in. But this guy... He really believes there's a significant find to be made. He's getting old, and he realizes that when this paper mill comes in, the chance will disappear forever. It'll be paved over, and you'll never be able to get to it. So he says, I'm going for it, you know, in the middle of the night, and he pays for it with his life.
He's not doing a job of a journalist, but he is digging.
That's exactly. Well, I mean, that's the thing. You notice what about me, if you've read my books. I don't go with conventional heroes of mystery or thriller. I don't write about cops and spies and that. I write about guys who have regular jobs, you know, lawyer, journalist, writer, mayor, because I think nothing against cops or anything else, but I like seeing normal people confronted with odds they're not trained to handle. They're not trained to handle violence. They're not trained to expect the things they confront. And then we can feel more what it would be like for us, you know.
I got to interview Layer Brown for his last book that he put out, Rabbit Factory, before he passed away. And I said, man, you ask a lot of your characters, don't you? And he goes, yeah, you take them and you just load them up with troubles.
There you go.
And you have done that in spades in this book. Boy, you put these folks through the ringer.
Well, you know what I'd say? They put themselves through the ringer. But most people I know do put themselves through the ringer. At some point in their life, people make decisions they know. Are the wrong thing to do, but they still do it. Now, why do we do that? I speculate on that in the book. It's not always a path of least resistance. Sometimes it's that people just can't quite accept happiness. They can't quite accept contentedness, and they push into something they think they need, and really they just want it.
The thing that Buck wants, he wants to discover Indian settlements going back 3,000-4,000 years and not just 400-500 years in that area. So can you tell us about Poverty Point and how that influenced this part of the story?
You know, I grew up, I was a fan of archaeology and all that. I didn't even realize that there were sites as old as there are in Louisiana. And I had a friend who told me about them. And, you know, the sites around Natchez are fantastic. Emerald Mound is a fantastic site. But I didn't realize that it wasn't that old, you know. And once I realized that it was a relatively new place, I was less interested in it, you know. I thought to think, wow, most of the Indian stuff I think about around Natchez, it was sort of at its peak when the French arrived. I mean, this is going to sound trivial. The opening of that movie Stargate with James Spader, the original one where they find the thing, and maybe the first 15 minutes of the movie where they bring him in to translate the Stargate and everything, that kind of, I'm just fascinated with that, or the Rosetta Stone or that stuff. So truly ancient finds fascinate me. And so the idea that that kind of thing existed within, you know, 45 miles of Natchez, I realized what was possible.
Is there a Rosetta Stone for you and your personality? Is there a touchstone that you can go back to that has all the information about it, how you became you?
Yeah, my first agent had a theory that you ask somebody what their first favorite children's book was would be usually the key to their personality. And in my case, it was a book called Artie the Smarty by Faith McNulty. You ever seen that?
No, I don't know that
one. Okay. It's about a fish. And every day, there's a bunch of fish down there. Artie's a smart fish. Every day, the fishermen come and they drop things down in the water, bait, tires, all nets. The fish get caught one by one, whatever. But Artie never gets caught. He manages to avoid it. The second I told my agent, she started laughing. She said, "My God, you proved my point. Look at you. Here you are, a thriller writer. And what are your characters doing? They're doing everything they can to avoid being caught. They're paranoid. They want to stay." And she said, "That's exactly your personality, too, right there." So maybe it's that. We all have defense mechanisms, and maybe that's the key to mine, you know.
It's a book that stayed with me, and I don't know the title of it. And I've looked for the title again, but there was a picture book when I was little, and there were these creatures. They kind of look like tapirs.
Uh-huh. And I know what those look like.
And they were traveling around an abandoned city, like humanity had died off.
Uh-huh.
And they were walking through, and grass had grown up through all the sidewalks and everything like that. And I just remember that very vividly, but I cannot find what that story was. But to me, I mean,
Taper might be the animals that they used in that first prehistoric scene in the movie 2001, actually.
That the apes killed?
That the apes are killing, yeah. Is that?
I can't remember. Similar? It's been such a long time since.
Okay,
I've
but
it.
You don't remember what that was, huh?
No, but
does that apply to your personality?
Yeah, because I think everything's going to end.
There you go.
All things end.
There you go. See? And for me, again, why? Why do I identify with a fish who feels like he's going to be killed? It's the same thing. It has to do with our fears, I think. You're worried everything's going to end. I worry I'm going to be, you know, caught and eaten. Well, how rational is that? It's not. But those are the things that drive us, you know.
So what do you think is the thing that's driving Marshall right now at the moment?
I think we all, male or female, have left somebody behind in our youth. The first person we loved, the first person we were intimate with, the first time we really fell in love with somebody or became infatuated to the point that we believe we were in love. And when you get your heart broken and you think, "My God, I'm never doing that again, ever." Okay. And Marshall, for the way things happen in his life, he never really quite let go of that. And his best friend married that woman. And because his father's dying, he comes back. He finds himself in a strange situation because that woman, instead of being a wife who toes the line, she basically says the door is open to go back to the past. And I think a lot of people would go back to the past. I mean, initially, I think Facebook thrived because so many people signed on and would sort of secretly lurk and look back for the people they went to high school with, people they were in love with, you know?
You know, you kind of have this warning about that, but then it's that very deep past of what might be underground.
Yeah.
That's controlling things. And it possibly keeping the city from moving forward in the future because there's a big paper mill coming. And if they find these remains there, then that's going to cast that project in
doubt. I never even thought about that. You're right, though. So really, this book in all ways is about buried truths, you know? What's going to be uncovered has the potential to destroy what's in the present. And let's be honest. That sometimes, I can't believe I'm going to say this, sometimes the past is best left in the past, because if anything, the whole Natchez Burning trilogy is about shining the light on the past, regardless of how terrible it is. But that's in a different thing. That's because what that is about is the the inequalities buried in our society that were never acknowledged, and whole peoples suffered from that. We're talking about personal things unknown. You know, a good example would be when there's infidelity in a marriage and the person who commits it, they reach a point where they get this confessional urge and they think, we're going to have a clean slate and I'm going to confess this. That's a terrible urge. What you really need to do is just live with the fact of what you did, shut up and never talk about it, because by confessing it, you force the other person to have to go through that pain now and forever, right? So should everything always be brought up? No. Uh-uh. I think people out there who've been married a long time, they know what I'm talking about.
Buck Ferris is murdered in that second chapter. He's struck in the head with a couple of blunt objects and lights out. The next morning, Marshall hears about it, and he's come back into town to run the newspapers for his father and his failing health. But why is he particularly interested in this Buck Ferris murder other than being a story?
Well, because Buck Ferris was a sort of a surrogate father for him. I mean, what's at the core of this book is the opposite of my past books, where Penn Cage had a wonderful relationship with his father, as I did with mine. Marshall has no relationship with his father. His father blames him for a tragedy in their family's past. Marshall left town vowing never to return. And so I think Buck Ferris was a scoutmaster who saw this kid isn't getting the attention that he needs. I'm going to help him out. And so he was sort of a surrogate dad, musician. He informed Marshall's upbringing. And so when he dies, it's sort of like his father dies, Marshall's father dies. And so he's interested. You know, but you got it something here that I want to say. This book is sort of deceptive in its opening. I tried to be honest in that prologue and say things aren't what they seem, because this book really sort of opens like a classic mystery novel. He said it opens with a murder and an investigation, but it takes a hard left turn when the second victim is killed the night of the party, because you start to think, wait a second, I thought I knew what I was reading about here. This is something different. This is not the murder of this archaeologist. There's something else happening.
When you started off the story, was that turn already there, or did you come upon it?
I knew the end point I was going for, because this whole book grew out of the secret at the end. And the secret at the end, as you know, this has never been in any book that I know of. I went all the way back to the Bible. There's a sort of off-angle version of it in the Bible, but I think it's something that's probably happened a lot in real life. In the same way that coroners tell me that they think pre-advanced microbiology, they think a lot of women probably poisoned their husbands. Just a fact, you know, got away with it. So I knew where I was going, and that had very little to do with the archaeologist, right? That has to do with the second murder.
But it's still history.
It's the kind of history that really matters in the present. You know, whether or not that Indian site is uncovered or not isn't really going to change everybody's life except economically. That other history could impact a lot of lives.
Marshall has befriended a son of one of his high school friends, Denny Allman. He's a little drone genius and going around getting footage and helping him out that. But did Marshall never think that he might be putting this kid in danger by involving him in a murder
investigation? I think he did. He did think about that, and he does what a lot of people do, which is he's going to try not to think about that because he needs what Denny can give him. I hate to say it, but people are guilty of that. People tend to do what's good for them and minimize risk. And that kid's based a little on my own son, Mark, who's kind of a drone genius really early on and just great with those things. But, I mean, I gave Denny a different background, and it turns out to be important. I think one of the best scenes in the book is when he comes on Denny's mother's Ford Explorer broken down, and here he is riding to the rescue. But, you know, that scene doesn't turn out. He sees himself as a savior, and it doesn't quite work that way.
She lets him know who he is.
To me, the book feels really real right there, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk about that poker club a little bit.
Okay.
Tell us about this civic cabal.
After the Civil War, when the Reconstruction was coming, the guys who had formerly held the levers of power in Bienville, they got together and said, you realize what's coming. I mean, we're going to live in an inverted world, you know? The Yankee carpetbaggers are coming. We're going to have black representatives, you know, in the Congress. And so they quietly did all they could to maintain control of power, and they waited out Reconstruction, which ended, you know, the North sort of gave up on it in the compromise. And so when that ended and federal troops left, they were holding on to all the power, and through their sons and sons and sons, they held it till now. And that's not so different from reality in some places in Mississippi.
Unlike the Silver Dollar guys, they had a very racial animus And that was kind of their driving philosophy. And the poker club is look out for number one, and it doesn't matter what race you are.
Poker club's all about the money. You could be in the poker club if you're black, if you got enough money, I think. You know, they'd never quite accept you, but you could be, you'd be part of the group, you know?
They let an Italian casino operator
yes,
in.
Yes, they do, because he's got the money, right? But they never quite let him forget that he doesn't completely fit, right? Let's be honest. It's not politically correct, but that's how it is in places like Mississippi.
In writing about the civil rights in the Natchez Burning Trilogy, and that, you know, a lot of folks can look back and say, well, yeah, that was bad. But then you have so many folks in this story who talk bad about Trump.
Yeah.
And so many of your neighbors, white neighbors down there, just think
Trumpers.
He's the second coming.
Yeah. I've already gotten a couple of horrible Amazon reviews that are hurting my ranking because I'm just getting my money back. You know, just for that.
Because of three sentences.
Three sentences, yeah. One guy said, how come Marshall's never on Fox? He said, is he a flaming liberal? And I said,
He was in Fox early on. He was on Lou Dobbs' show.
Lou was on CNN
and
that
back at the time.
But I said, you know, he'd probably go on Shepard Smith, but that's the only thing right there. So I earned another enemy right there.
You're really generous, I think, being an author. You name-check other authors in the course of the story. You got Angie Thomas and Jessamyn Warren and Wiley Cash. You know, how do you pick who you're going to big up in the story?
I happen to think of Wiley. Wiley tweets a lot. I have not met Wiley in person, but we've corresponded about a couple things. He's a nice guy and a good writer. I wanted Nadine Sullivan. I knew she ran a certain kind of store, and so I thought I didn't want just a Mississippi writer necessarily, so I picked a guy who I thought would be the kind of writer she'd know and like and whatever. So I kind of left Wiley in there as a placeholder, and then by the end it was like, well, he got it. He got the spot, right? And then the ones on the wall, those are people I admire. You know, I had read Chris Offutt's book, autobiography right around the time I was writing this. Or the one I love is the Bobby Gentry picture, because Bobby Gentry's a recluse and nobody gets to talk to her, you know.
Nadine is very similar to Marshall in that she's moved back to town. She moved back down to take care of her mother, who was in ill health a few years before. Yeah. But she's managed to keep her head down a little bit. And even though she was a lawyer in her former life, whereas Marshall just can't help but sticking his head up and getting whacked.
You know, my favorite scene is when they're in the bookstore and the orthodontist, who's just, you know what, comes in and sort of lecturing Marshall about sticking his nose in and stirring up trouble. And Nadine just, oh, man, just lets him have it. And Marshall's like, wow, I really enjoyed that. You know, I admire you. And you get the truth from her there, too. And she says, you know, if I didn't have the money that I have, which she got from a personal injury case, right? She said, if I didn't have that, I'd have had to sit there and take that, you know? And it's sort of a fantasy, I think, of people not to have to sit there and take stuff.
So they have this big old party to celebrate the coming of the paper mill dill, and you got the killer there. And, you know, I've been thinking in the past couple of years, how would the killer and Elvis and all the Chuck Berry have fared in the Me Too era of nowadays?
Oh, God, they you know, be in jail. I mean, the funny thing, if you read Rick Bragg's book, I mean, it's not funny, but it shines a light on the South as it really was. Jerry Lee gets so much publicity for marrying Myra, you know, who was 13. But Rick Bragg points out that it wasn't like some kind of radical thing where Jerry Lee was from. Jerry Lee's own sister got married when she was 12. So for Jerry Lee, when it thing blew up in London, he really was confused. He didn't understand it. You know, where he had been, the parents supported it. You know, but it just shows you what the South was like. I mean, so in the 50s, the South was still like it was 100 years before when it came to the mores and folkways of things like marriage. So, but when you look at Elvis and Priscilla and, you know, a lot of that, people don't really dwell on that. But it's Rick Bragg pointed out, it's interesting that Jerry Lee gets crucified and Elvis sort of gets a pass. Mm-hmm. In the Me Too era, Elvis wouldn't have got a pass, you know. And that's forgetting whatever he may have done on the road or whatever. I mean, let's don't even go there. But even in terms of just his marriage and all that.
Now, the Chinese company that's coming to bring this paper mill into town is called Azure Dragon. So where did that name come from?
Well, yeah, just Google that. That's that has significance in the Chinese culture, and they're – you're not going to comment on that, trust me.
Well, now I've got to go Google stuff. Thanks.
Sorry about that.
Now, later on in the book, there was this great line, and especially since I'm Gen X – kid. Okay. In which he said, a lot of friends I grew up with have become their parents as they age. Gen X slackers morphing into racist xenophobes they would have hated in their 20s.
Now, you know what? I knew that was true of my generation. I'm at the tail end of the baby boomers. I wasn't sure it was true of Gen X. But my buddy, who's my first editor who ever found me, I was talking to him, and he goes, oh, yeah, you wouldn't believe the people I went to school with. And I'm just stunned at what they've become, you know, as they age. It's something I don't even understand. How is it people I knew who were sort of like in 1975, they were, I've seen them take hits off of weed and they're listening to Fleetwood Mac and they're liberal. And now they're rabid Trumpers, you know, it's something.
Well, the only place they've ever been is Destin or Gulf Shores.
I'm not even going to comment, but yeah, there's something to be said for that.
Getting around the world change your opinion on things.
Getting around the country can change your opinion on things, you know. But one more thing on that. What is it about, though? I've seen that happen even when the people don't live near their parents. That's the interesting part. They may have left the South or they may have gone to a big city, but it's almost like they're still living under their parents' roof, and they morph into almost exactly what the parent was. So it shows the power of what's transferred when someone is a child, you know, unconsciously, subconsciously. And that's something worth exploring. Well, when I get involved in all these debates and I get so frustrated and I get involved in politics, somebody, I don't know who said this, but they are so right. They said, a person can't be reasoned out of something they weren't reasoned into in the first place. And man, truer words were never spoken.
We haven't really talked about Jet. She might as well be, her name be Thelma in the Jimmy Rogers song, because she has made a wreck out of folks.
She's a different kind of character. I think she's a super strong character. I think women are going to like her. But I think she made some choices in her life. We don't know what they are till the very, very end. Somebody pointed out something the other day that I thought was pretty smart. To me, what Jet reveals in the end is the truth. She's telling the truth. But what somebody pointed out, and this is where the reader function comes in. Somebody said, you know, I don't necessarily accept the last thing Jet says as being the bottom line of what really happened, because who knows? It may be that what she believes is what she has to tell herself to live or what she did. Yep. Who knows what really she was feeling at the time, you know?
Well, and you think back to her childhood with her father leaving her and going back to
Jordan,
and then mixed culture and a culture that's not appreciated in
right,
the South.
Right.
And she's there being raised by a single mom, and she's just got to find her place in that society.
That's right. Isn't that funny? Yeah. I don't want to comment too much. You know, you get into where characters grew out of, it's better just to let readers find their way.
Okay. Know? So I was on your website looking at your itinerary for the tour, and man, you are hitting it hard. 2-3 stops a day.
Well, it's about velocity at the start, you know. It's a competitive business, and when I do these things, a lot of people come out. And so, you know, if you're in a competitive game, you might as well, you know, give it 100%. People in Mississippi are so great. They come out, Tennessee, up here. I was in Little Rock the other day, just zipped over, and big crowd. So it's fun to do. It'll wear you out. But 8 years as a musician, I've been down this road plenty of times, you know.
I'm a fan of thrillers, and of course I love your books. But as a guy who interviews authors, I'm asking, have you ever thought about writing a shorter book?
You know, what's 600 pages? That's short for me. Come on, Steve. I say that, nobody gets it, but I mean, come on. No, I have, and I wish I could. Why do I write long, really, is the question. I tend to write one in a very granular way. You know, if you look back at a book like Natchez Burning and realize it's 800 pages long and only 3.5 days pass, try to imagine that. But then, as you know, there are a lot of flashbacks. There's a lot of historical context. There's psychological depth. I've written a couple shorter books, and, you know, I'd like to do it that way. It just never seems to work out that way, you know?
Now, I remember a couple of years ago when you came by the station, y'all were driving a Ford Flex.
Yeah.
And that truck shows up all the time in this story.
In this story.
And I was wondering if you were going to get a deduction for your lease on it or anything like that.
No, I ought to get some kind of sponsorship, man. They're about to stop making that. So really, this is sort of a swan song for the vehicle, I think, in this book. I almost bought a big Lincoln Navigator prior to this tour, because I brought my guitar out and an amp, and it started getting crowded. And I got a one-year-old son, believe it or not, so... Wow, that Flex is getting a little smaller.
That black edition with the extended wheelbase.
Yeah.
It's just such a beautiful beast.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
You got anything in the works right now?
Yeah, I'm working on about three things. I don't want to say what they are, and nobody knows what they are. But coming out to promote like this, you know, usually when I'm working on something, I really don't think very much about what is it people want to read or what does the market want or anything like that. But I'm sitting on a couple of the best ideas. I've been sitting on a couple ideas for 10 years because they don't quite fit in the box of what's expected. And I'm really thinking it might be time to do one of those and just completely blow people out of the water, because I think that's the kind of thing where instead of incrementally growing your audience, you could add a million people. You know, you do. Well, I mean, look, let's face it. The guys I like to read, I noticed something. Go back to the spy novels. Go to whatever. Anybody who wrote consistently over a long period, you notice they sort of, they could still write, but they, you realize culturally they lost touch. They weren't part of the mainstream anymore. It had to do with age, I'm sure. You try to stay current, you try to stay relevant, and I don't want to just age into irrelevance and not stay current. I'd rather deal with a new subject, and thankfully, in my career, I haven't just been in one genre or rewritten the same book. Now, they don't want me to just, you know, take a wild left turn, but that doesn't mean I won't, you know.
They still want that page turner.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, look, I want a page turner. If somebody's not going to read the book, you hadn't accomplished anything. But that doesn't mean you have to, it has to be something by the numbers or something they've seen before. Give them something they can't stop reading, and they're just like, oh, my God, what is this? I can't stop.
That's different from being a musician where they always want to hear the old stuff and they don't want to hear anything from the new album.
No, I think it's exactly the same. You're right. I think anytime you try something new, even in books, you know, let's think of an example. I mean, if Lee Child tomorrow started writing cozies about a female sleuth living in, you know, South Haven, it's not going to be, you know, it's going to be like, wait a second, what?
You know, I would read that book in a heartbeat.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Truthfully, he's got a loyal fan base, so they'd go with him. But you know what I'm saying? It's, they want to hear satisfaction and sympathy for the devil.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you so much for staying way too late at this event to talk to us.
Thank you. Thanks. It was fun. It's always fun. You always read the books and you read them thoroughly, and that's more than a lot of interviewers do. So it's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah.
Greg Iles is the author of Cemetery Road, published by William Morrow. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.